Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. Personally, it's a happy one for me, having missed out one satsang, to be back on this segment, and I'm grateful to Swami for this opportunity. Tomorrow is a very, very special day, a day that we, as Sai devotees, hold very, very dear to our heart, because it is the day when we offer our homage and our gratitude at the lotus feet of our Divine Master, our Bhagwan. It is the day of Guru Purnima, the full moon day, which has been reserved for reverence, worship, prayerful prostrations, and for love to be showered on one's own Guru. And for us, it becomes multiple times special, because it is a day when we can offer our gratitude to Swami. Of course, even if we offer every day in gratitude to Swami, it is not enough, because that is the amount of love He showers on us. That is how He does things selflessly for us. In fact, I remember one devotee, she was saying that even if I peel my skin and with that make footwear for Bhagwan, that will not be gratitude enough. That was quite a graphic way of describing it, but we can understand the feeling where one is so overwhelmed by the love and grace of the Guru, the Divine Guru, on all of us, that we know that whatever we do, we can never repay the debt. But that's the speciality of the Sadguru, of the Divine Guru, that He expects no debt. So we are on the threshold of one such momentous day, which is the Guru Purnima day tomorrow. So it is natural that today's satsang will be on the theme of the Guru, the role that the Guru plays in our life, the gratitude that we must have for the Guru in our lives. So that is the satsang we will be entering into, as always, by offering our humble gratitude and pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan. So before we begin and go further into the theme, let me welcome Brother Prem to the show. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Anvind, and yes, it's Guru Purnima is one of the most important festivals in the Indian calendar, especially the calendar of Prashanti. Because for us as students, I think Guru Purnima used to be the first festival. When we were in Vrindavan, the first festival for which we used to come to Parthi, Our Parthi visits would start with that. And a festival which was very poignant. You know, I think the other festivals, with due respect to all the festivals, they were more festivals than their observances. But Guru Purnima somehow was a solemn festival all through. You know, Swami would often say when he is talking about other festivals that it's not only eating, it's not only having new clothes, you know, be it New Year, Ugadi or Diwali or something. You always have that jolly part of that festival. But somehow Guru Purnima itself was a very serious observance by the nature of the festival itself, where you are remembering and you are revering your Guru. And the concept of Guru, of course, is so central to the idea of spirituality itself, the spiritual progress. So in many ways, Guru Purnima is a very, very important festival, and to be able to spend that over and over again with Swami gave us that opportunity. At least as long as we were students, he ensured that every Guru Purnima we got the opportunity to celebrate with him. This Guru Purnima is also special because it marks the 50th year of a Guru Purnima that Swami celebrated outside of India. Probably the only Guru Purnima which was celebrated outside of Prashantinilayam also, maybe. I think one Guru Purnima Swami celebrated in Vrindavan. I don't know if in between he has celebrated Guru Purnimas in other cities, but definitely the only Guru Purnima celebrated outside of India,
which is the Guru Purnima in Africa. Yes, as you said, Guru Purnima has often been the poignant and a kind of very profound festival, because even if we go 5 years before that Guru Purnima which you were referring to in 1968, that was the Guru Purnima of 1963. That is when actually Bhagwan chose to reveal himself as the Shiva Shakti.
Right.
And I mean, if we go into that, that will be an entire satsang itself. Probably we can take that up for a future satsang, the happenings of the Guru Purnima of 1963, when Bhagwan revealed himself as Shiva Shakti. So Guru Purnima is definitely something very, very special, and that's because a guru is very, very special in one's life. Swami would often say that the mother is the one who shows the father to the child, and the father is the one who shows the teacher to the child. What's very interesting is the father is the one who shows the teacher, not the guru. Because a guru is not somebody or someone whom one can search for. It is always believed that the disciple is someone whom the guru searches for. All that the disciple or the shishya has to do is to get prepared and be patient in readiness, because when the time is ripe, the guru will himself or herself drop at one's doorstep to pick up the disciple. Because, you know, many times Swami would say that poem, Vetakutunnanu, Vetakutunnanu, which means I'm searching, I'm searching. And he would say it in the context that as devotees, you say you're searching for God, but you don't realize that I'm actually searching for a true devotee. Because you consider yourselves as devotees, but none of us are actually truly devotees. That is why God is in search of a devotee. I think the same thing can be said about a guru and a disciple also. It is the guru, the Satguru, when we talk of, when we say guru, it's not like our school teacher or a kindergarten teacher or our college teacher. They teach, they are teachers. But a guru is someone who is always in search of a disciple, one who is ready to undertake this journey. And therefore, the guru is so important in one's life. And, you know, as they say, mother shows the father shows the teacher. It is the guru who shows God. The teacher actually teaches us and shows us the way to live in the world. The guru teaches us something that is useful not only in this world, but in all the worlds that are going to come next. And therefore, Guru Purnima assumes this massive importance.
And whenever Swami speaks about Guru Purnima, you know, Swami would define the meaning of the word guru. In fact, from that itself, much of what we're going to speak can be derived. But one of the things which Swami would say, and very beautifully, he would say that, you know, guru is one who removes the darkness. You know, the one who removes the darkness from your sight is the guru. I think there's a very beautiful shloka that even in school we all used to chant, that Agnyanatimirantasya.
Jnananjanashalayakaya. Chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha.
So it says that, you know, there is this darkness of ignorance in your eye. No, even though you see, you don't see, as they beautifully say in the Upanishad.
Pashyanna pina pashyati.
Right? You see, but you don't see. Because of the ignorance that is there as part of your vision itself. So the shloka says that the guru applies the collyrium of, you know, jnana in your eyes so that you're able to see what is in front of your eye, and you see beyond the veil of ignorance. And Swami would tell one very beautiful chinnakatha, you know, I think we've quoted it many times, mm-hmm. where there is this man who walks into a dark room which is strewn with furniture. It's, you know, may not be necessarily furniture which is not arranged properly, even arranged furniture. I mean, even if we walk into a studio and it's pitch dark here, you know, we would keep banging into every bit of furniture and the chairs which are here. So Swami says, man is trying to move around in the world like that person. He was in this dark room, banging into the walls and banging into the furniture. The guru does not come and lead you necessarily from point A to point B or the way out of the room. The guru only comes and switches on the light. And then you're able to fend for yourself. You're able to find the path yourself. So literally, Swami would say that that's what the guru does. He does not necessarily hold your hand and walk you through the path. He enlightens your path by which you can do the walking yourself. In fact, you know, whenever Swami says Guru Purnima is nothing but Vyasa Purnima, Swami would say Vyasa has given 18 Puranas. Vyasa has written this, Vyasa has written that, he has given the whole Upanishads. But after all that, you have to do it, right? He says, even that great Vyasa cannot help you if you do not choose to listen to what is being told to you. So at the end of it, you know, it appears like the role of the Guru is quite limited in that sense. You might have the best of the Gurus, like we are fortunate to have God himself as a Jagat Guru, as a Sadguru. But even then, you and I have to choose to follow to be able to benefit from that presence of the Guru.
Truly, you know, summing up what you said, it is like the Guru makes us independent. He doesn't hold our hand and walk across the room. I mean, he even will do that, possibly to give us courage and solace, and that is what we will see ahead in the satsang, that for some time possibly the guru will also do that. He'll hold our hand and help. But that is not the idea. The idea is to make one independent, and that is why it is best summed up by how you said, he puts on the light and he says, now you can see for yourself, you can yourself avoid the furniture, you can yourself ensure a safe passage across the room. So he puts on the light to make us independent. And Swami had mentioned that true independence is when you are independent. That is, you are dependent on what is within you, because Swami would say that everything is within already. It is just that you have to discover it. And that is the reason why, as the Supreme Guru, the Chancellor of the Sri Satya Institute of Higher Learning, you know, I don't think that it's a coincidence that it's called higher learning, because Swami would always want that higher learning to stand for Atma Vidya and not the bookish knowledge. And that was his goal as a chancellor also, to make us independent. You know, we are dependent on what is within. That is why he defined educare as the process of eliciting what is already within, to make patent what is latent. It is not how modern education is looked at, as stuffing so much into a being, but it's about eliciting what is already within, because Swami would say everything is within. So ultimately, the guru's job is this, to make everyone independent. And independent means the dependency on the guru too is gone. And if we look at interactions and how Swami has dealt with so many people, including our own selves, when we look at our lives, we will realize that every time Swami has done this, yes, he has given a helping hand, he has helped us out in some situations, but it is not as if that every time that situation comes, we call on to him and he helps us in the same way. If we look back at our lives and see, slowly but surely, what Swami has done is tried to move from giving us food to teaching us how to fend for ourselves, from, you know, giving us his hand to putting on the light to ensure that we become independent, because that is the ultimate aim of the guru. Because Swami would say, the mother shows the father shows the teacher or the guru, and the guru is the one who shows God. And that God is nothing else but the divinity that is present in each and every one of us. And if we truly find that God, it means, whether we call it enlightenment or realization, it just means that we become God ourselves, which means we should not be dependent on anything else. That is what is independence, and that is what the guru does.
Often I think of this analogy, you know, let's say that you had a fracture or something, and you're bedridden, they put a cast and you're bedridden. When you begin to start walking after probably 3 months of bed rest or something, they give you something, they give you a crutches or a walker or something like that. And that enables you to walk. But if someone were to come and ask you, how are you completely fine? You'll say, no, I'm not completely fine. You're completely fine only when you can walk independent of the walker also. Correct. Even though the walker has enabled you to walk, you're actually fine only when you're able to walk without the walker. And in that sense, you know, we are probably like that, injured, not able to walk. The guru enables you to walk, but you're really completely healed only when you do not need the support of the guru himself. You know, that is when you're actually complete, the journey is complete. And that's why Swami says, guru not only is the one who removes the darkness, but Swami would also give the definition, gunatita and rupavarjita, which means the true guru is actually without a form and without an attribute, and that is the guru within. And that's why that what you said was very important, independence. That finally your dependence is only on the guru within, and not even on an embodied guru outside, even if he is God embodied in a form.
And that is why, you know, the Aradhana Day or the Mahasamadhi Day gets so much significance, attains so much of importance, because it is not a cruel blow that the avatar delivered on the devotees. It is an absolute essential step in the evolution, because after having done everything, if finally we give up our dependence on everything worldly but continue with complete dependence only on that form, then it is still a dependence, which means we are not independent. And therefore, for the sake of that independence, though it looks like a very harsh and cruel thing, it is very hard on our minds and bodies, the guru does it, because the guru has selfless love. And selfless love is a love that transcends the body and mind. Even at the cost of hurting the body and mind, those things are done, because that is what is good for the soul that is evolving. And therefore, you know, Even means I feel that is the highest act of love that Bhagwan did on all of us. If we actually look back with wisdom, the Mahasamadhi is not the Bhagwan shedding the physical body, is not a cruel blow for us, but it is an, again, like all the acts that Swami did throughout his life, that too is an act of supreme love and sacrifice. And that is one of the traits supreme love and sacrifice. That is one of the traits of a Sadguru.
Swami would give this very beautiful analogy, comparing the role of a guru to that of a mother. Swami would say that when the mother is an infant, the mother has to give all her attention to the child. The feeding does not happen without the mother. The mother is the one who gives bath and puts the child to sleep. But Swami would say if the child is a school-going child, Swami would say that she'll prepare the food, she'll keep everything ready, and when the child comes, she'll serve the food and she'll go away with to take care of other works. And she would say that when the child becomes a little older, maybe a young adult or a teen or something, when the child comes back from school, the mother will say, okay, the food is in the kitchen, help yourself. Right? So actually the mother is making the child independent of her. And Swami would say that which mother would want the child to be constantly dependent on her? All mothers are keen to see the child grow up, right? Even as you are caring for the child as a little child and you're giving it all the love that you can, you're also harboring that desire that this child should become independent of me, should be able to take the food herself and eat, or himself and eat, or should be able to dress up herself. Because that is a sign of growth. No mother will, out of the love, say that this child should be dependent on me all through life. And that's the selflessness of the mother, and that's the same selflessness the guru embodies. And Swami would say that is what is lacking in modern day gurus, because the modern day gurus will go out of business if they make you independent of him.
I remember there's this son who becomes a doctor, and his father is also a doctor. The son is a doctor, and the son comes and tells his father one day very proudly, he says, "Father, do you know Mr. So-and-so? He has been suffering from this disease, from the last 15 years, and you have been treating him. Father, I just want to share my joy with you that I have managed to cure him." Okay, so the son thinks that it is something of great pride. The father hits him on his head and says, "You fool, who do you think paid for your medical fees?" It's not that I didn't know how to cure him, it's just that I wanted him dependent on me because it meets my selfish ends. And as you rightly said,
you saying this as a joke, I'm telling you, my uncle who's a doctor actually narrated an incident like this.
Oh my God.
Where one of his colleagues or students, sent him a patient with a skin disease. And that patient has been undergoing treatment for the past 1.5 years. And he spent a lot of money in that treatment and buying medicines and all of that. And he came to my uncle and he looked at him and said, "Yeah, this is the problem," and gave him a medicine, and within 2 weeks he was cured. Right? And then he got a call from this doctor who referred this patient to him. And in the course of the conversation, he asked, "What about that patient?" And I said, "Yeah, this was the problem he had, and I gave him this medicine, he's fine." And the doctor said, "Sir, what are you doing like this? I made a lot of money in 1 year. I sent him to you so that you can also make some money." And my uncle was shocked. He said, "A patient comes to you to be cured, literally in that sense that the patient should reach a state where he does not depend on your medicine, right? That's the motive of a doctor treating a patient. And truly, if you have any amount of selfishness in the service that you're offering, you will not want to make that person independent. And that's why Swami would often say, the greatest gift that you can give a person who's poor is to empower that person with education. That's when you're actually helping that person to fend for himself or herself, not by giving a hungry man a fish. Rather teach that person fishing than give a fish a day. So you find ways of empowering that person so that that person does not depend on you anymore. And that's what a true guru does. Not as Swami would say, there's so many other gurus who are dependent on running the ashram based on the disciples who come to them.
Another point, that arises in the mind is when we say that in the beginning the mother gives her own milk, and then she shifts the baby to bottled milk. Finally, she tells the food is in the fridge, and later on, mother possibly teaches the child how to cook also. Yeah. So, and we equate it to Swami hand holding us in the beginning, getting in finally to a stage where he's physically not with us also. That might raise a question, what about the babies now? Now, the mother is not there physically. I just would like to clarify that when we say Swami hand holds, it doesn't mean only in the physical sense. Because I'm sure Prem will agree, because he himself has experienced this kind of hand holding by Bhagwan, where physically Swami is not holding hand, Swami is not speaking much, Swami is not interacting at all, and yet yet you see his hand holding throughout your life. And I'm sure that there are also devotees, there are many experiences of the other end also, where physically possibly Swami is speaking to you on a day-to-day basis, but you still feel that you are not getting the support in the spiritual sphere, because this is a time when Swami has decided that you have to move to the next stage of picking the food from the fridge yourself or cooking your own food. So I just thought I should make this point here, that when we say like the mother taking care of an infant, to a mother taking care of a teenager, to a mother taking care of an adult, that doesn't directly equate to amount of time or energy Swami spent physically. Even to this day, you know, and I'm sure one or two examples will come up in the remaining satsang, that we see this happening where without actually having come to Swami, people have had this hand holding done, where Swami has guided them, pulled them out of misery, pulled them out of deep ditches of sorrow, depression and terrible habits, and actually resurrected them, just like a mother will do to an infant, and then got started them on this journey towards independence. So just want to make this point here, that when we say Swami holds hand, it is not in the physical sense, it is always in the spiritual sense, and even to this day it continues to happen on a worldwide scale.
And absolutely, I think it's a very important point that you brought up, because you know that's why you have personalities like Ekalavya. You know, we've always spoken about him. Without the direct contact of the Guru, he was able to become as good as the best disciple of the Guru. Hmm. You know, there were, if you see Drona's disciples, even Duryodhana, Dushasana and all of them were actually disciples of Drona. They were not as good as Arjuna. Arjuna was his best student, and Ekalavya, without the direct contact of the Guru, could become as good as Arjuna, or even better. There was no contest between them to decide that. And that is why they say that, and that is the importance why the other word which Swami uses for Guru is very important. Swami uses the word Acharya, right? Mm. And for Acharya, Swami gives the explanation, the one who teaches by action, right? Acharinchi chupinchunavadu, Swami would say, is Acharya. Mm. So in that sense, you know, you're not directly being guided by Swami, probably saying that this is right, this is wrong, but you are observing Swami and you are correcting your ways, right? And that opportunity is available for anybody, right? And that is why a guru comes and lives for so many years, or God comes in the human form and lives for so many years, where his life is observable and life is studyable, right? And when you study his life, you know, he becomes an acharya. You're looking at him and you say, this is what he likes, this is what he expects, this is what he did when he was in, you know, different stages in his life. So that's what I need to do. So that is actually when you're saying that like a mother, he directly takes care of you. It is this role that he plays, where you directly observe him and you know what is right and what is wrong.
On that point, dear listeners, we will take a quick little break. On the other side of the break, we will be discussing three roles that a guru plays in our life. There are many, many roles that he plays, but three important roles. And we have picked these three roles because of what Bhagwan has said in the Ramayana about the three gurus that came into Lord Rama's life and the roles that they played in Rama's life. We will be picking up those three roles and discussing and enjoying a beautiful satsang on how Bhagwan does those same three roles in our lives. So don't go away anywhere. We will be taking a very quick break and we will be back after that with the three roles that a guru plays in our lives.
गुरु संग के साथ जीवन है तुम संग सारे बंधन है तुम संग सारे बंधन है जीवन नैया पार उतारे जीवन नैया जीवन पार उतारे तुम ही हमारे जीवन जीवन सहारे, तुम ही हमारे जीवन सहारे। कैसा गुरु संग कैसा जीवन है, गुरु संग कैसा। गुरु की महिमा, गुरु की वाणी, तन तन के मुख जगा पहचाने। गुरु की महिमा, गुरु की वाणी, संतन के मुख जग पहचाने। दूर तमस कर ज्ञान सरोवर ना जाने, मूरख अभिमानी। गुरु ही ब्रह्मा, गुरु ही विष्णु, गुरु ही सबके पालनहारे। गुरु ही ब्रह्मा, गुरु ही विष्णु, गुरु ही सबके पालनहारे। इस मोह के सागर
dear listeners, we are discussing about the role of a guru. In fact, we have not yet started the real meat of the discussion that we wanted to have. We spoke about the importance of guru according to the definitions of the word guru itself, Swami has said, and the compassion of a guru. And we're going to be talking about that a little more, because as I was telling somebody, you know, when we were having this discussion of how do you define Swami? And this concept, this talk came that you should define Swami as love. But the fact is, we don't know love itself. You know, how do you define Swami whom you don't know with a quality which you have not, which you are not completely aware of?
You know, it reminds me of an English teacher we had where he would use a very complex word and we would not understand it, and I would raise my hand and ask what is the meaning of that word. The synonym that he would give would make me raise my hand again because I don't know even the synonym that he's giving.
Right. You know, that's what happens with the... I mean, when you're trying to
love.
Define Swami with love, actually it's the other way around. You know, yes, Swami is the best embodiment of the love, even the limited love that we understand. But after that, actually you define the idea of love with Swami. You start observing Swami and say, okay, this is what will happen if somebody selflessly loves. I think same is the case with Guru. To an extent, you can look at the Guru and say, okay, he's the one who selflessly loves me. But after a certain point, you have to start defining the idea of selfless love based on the words and the actions of a guru. And that is the trick in a sense, because that's where a lot of people miss out. When they find that Swami shifts more to that aspect of the guru, where you are supposed to go beyond your idea of right and wrong, good and bad, compassion and love, that's when people say, oh, now Swami is not as loving as he was before, or you start seeking for the same selfless love or same kind of pampering from somebody else, and that's the problem actually.
In fact, I remember recently seeing a talk on YouTube where somebody has been asked this, and very intelligently and nicely he answers. He says, a true guru is one who makes you uncomfortable in his presence. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you cannot leave his presence and go away because you miss him and you can't stay without him. That is an ideal guru. Not one with in whose presence you are always completely comfortable. Because he was saying that is how you look, search for your friends. Those who are compatible with you at your intellectual level, those who don't puncture your ego. Such people are those whom you select as your friends. And that's why a friend is not considered a guru. A friend is a friend. A guru will make us feel uncomfortable because he wants to prod us higher. You know, when I want to build my body, I put my body through uncomfortable situations. I do push-ups, pull-ups, which is painful, which is strainful. And yet I do it because I know that it will build my body. If that is the case with the body, the same is the case with the mind. I put my mind through its paces and put it through stress and strain so that my mind is sharpened, my intellect is better. Why should it not hold true even in the spiritual sense? That is why when we are truly building up our spiritual selves, we will feel the stress and strain and discomfort. And that is why a guru is one who makes us feel the discomfort. And yet at the same time, there is that bonding that I can't, though I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'm unable to leave his presence and go. And I like that definition of a guru. And when I thought of Swami, it resonated so well. It's not like we would be very pally. There are many times when we are sitting in Bhagwan's presence and we have that sense of, if you can say, fear or discomfort because of multiple reasons. Possibly because of what I have done. Possibly because of the confidence that Swami knows everything that is going on within me. So there is that level of discomfort and alertness. And at the same time, it is not that because there is discomfort, I can leave Swami and go away. I have to be with him. I can't think of life without him. And in some cases where, you know, that level of discomfort has gone, there are examples of those kind also. If the discomfort is gone and you become extremely comfortable with Swami, it leads to Maya enveloping where you come and say that, you know what, Swami is normal like anybody. I don't know what is divine about him. And it leads you to treat Swami as a very loving human being, forgetting that he is the divine guru who can take you beyond and give you the ultimate in life. Therefore, I like this definition where a guru is someone who, in whose presence you are having a certain amount of discomfort, but it is a presence that you cannot imagine living without.
Even as you say this, a series of thoughts are coming to my mind because, one thing is what you said. You choose a friend to be a friend. You know, you choose a guru to be a guru. I think that's a very, very important thing which we miss out these days. You know, a father is trying to become a friend. A mother is trying to become a friend. A father and a mother can be friendly. You know, a child, when the child grows up, will have many friends, but it will have only one mother and father. So the mother and father have to play that role. Similarly, when Swami is asked, you know, what is the best way to relate to Swami? When one of the students asked this question to Swami, Swami said, you have to look at me as a guru. Because you can look at Swami as my mother and my friend and all that, but at the end of it, you should remember that he is a guru. He is here to impart a certain wisdom. And that's what Swami, calls attention to what Krishna tells in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. When Arjuna asks him, I think he's asking him about devotion and all that, and he says, Krishna defines devotion as bhakti, as friendship with fear. He says, you have friendship, you feel close to God. At the same time, you know that
You cannot take it for granted.
You have to have that fear. So that closeness which comes with friendship, filled with fear, is only his bhakti. And, you know, that is why the idea, the role of a guru is actually not just of a teacher. Right? Guru is actually the mother, father, friend, and the teacher rolled into one. It's not that of a teacher of a school in that sense. You can learn from a lot of people, but you are enlightened by the guru. Right? And when we were talking about what about the children who are coming now who do not have the access to Swami.
Physical access.
Physical access to Swami. You know, we were talking to some of these students from the Anantapur campus as part of the Golden Jubilee celebrations. The Telugu team happened to interview a couple of students who have joined now. And this question was asked to them, what role does Swami play in your life? And very spontaneously, you know, the person who was interviewing was surprised by the clarity with which that came. That young sister, she said, Swami has crossed that level long ago. He no more plays the role of a mother or a father or a guru or a, you know, any individual like that. He's all of that put together. You know, when you first relate to Swami, you relate to him through any one of these roles. Because that's the extension of what you already know. But truly, Swami is above all of that. And, you know, in many ways, the idea of a guru defines that kind of, you know, he's all of this and more than that. And that's why finally Arjuna had to say that, look, I know nothing. Please teach me. Till then, he's saying that, oh, you're my brother-in-law. You know, you're this. You're my charioteer. But finally, in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, I don't know anything. Accept me as your disciple and you teach me. And that's when actually Krishna starts giving clarity. And that's why the role of a guru or looking up to Swami as a guru, yes, Swami is a friend. Yes, Swami is a mother. Yes, Swami is a father. Yes, he's, you know, the dearest of the dear and all of that. But you should always remember that he is the master and you're a disciple.
It is often said, follow the words of Krishna and follow the actions of Rama. Because among these two avatars, the Rama avatar came, and we have discussed this in detail when we did the series of satsangs on the Ramkatha Rasavahini, that is Bhagwan's own rendering of the Ramayana. So Rama came as an avatar to show man how you should lead life as a perfect man. And therefore, it is proper that we look at Rama's life to understand the roles, the different roles a guru plays in life, because the actions of Rama are to be followed. During the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang, we discuss Sandipani, we discuss the guru of Lord Krishna as well. But if we look at the life of Lord Sri Rama, Swami has spoken about three distinct times or three distinct gurus that come in the early life of Rama, that is before Rama's wedding to Sita. In fact, in the Adhyatma Ramayana, which is the spiritual Ramayana, Rama is compared to the Jivatma or the individual being, the individual soul. And Mother Sita is compared to Brahma Vidya, Atma Vidya. And the union of Rama and Sita, that is a wedding, is considered as the Jivatma attaining Brahma Vidya. So that is the Adhyatma Ramayana, and this also we had discussed when we did the Ramkatha Rasavahini Satsang. So before the actual wedding of Rama and Sita, three different gurus come in Rama's life. And dear listeners, today we will be going into each of those three episodes from Rama's life, and then we will discuss further on that.
And in fact, this is probably a very important way of looking at Ramayana. When we went through the Ramkatha Rasavahini, we made it very clear it is very autobiographical, and the consistency of the character of Rama, the way Swami maintained, was that of an avatar. You know, there is no moment where there is depression, there is confusion, like how Valmiki writes or the other authors tend to write. But Swami also mentions this, that the Adhyatmika Ramayana is one way of looking at Ramayana. And, you know, when Swami would often say, I am God, so are you. I know it, but you don't know it. So there's so much of importance in the mind knowing that this Atma is God. Even though you have the Atma, the mind has to know it. So they would say that the mind with the knowledge that the Atma is God is Sita. So that is why this Jivatma is actually going through this course to attain the mind which has this knowledge that it is God itself.
Divine.
Divine. And that is why the Ramayana itself is the journey of a Jivatma. And if you consider Ramayana as a journey of the Jivatma, you can distinctly see three gurus coming in the life, especially till the point where Sita is attained. And of course, just to clarify what happens after the marriage of, you know, Rama and Sita, why Sita is taken away and not completely can be explained in that sense. I think we spoke about it when we were doing the Ramakatha Rasamayini Satsang itself. Swami would say that there are two different muktis. One is Jivan Mukti, where you have Savikalpa Samadhi. You have the mind and you still are enlightened. That is what is the union of Rama and Sita. But that is not enough. You have to get the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, where there is no aberrations in the mind at all. That is when the mind, with the knowledge that Atma is God, is also removed. And that's why they say even in the Ramayana, they show that after a certain point, Sita has to go back to her source. The Jivatma has to remain without the mind. That is the final Nirvikalpa Samadhi in that sense.
And the other point that came in my mind right now as we were discussing this is possibly the reason why, if we look at the different dramas or the different plays staged in Bhagwan's presence, and even the scripts that Swami himself wrote, the songs that Swami composed, they all centered around the wedding of Rama and Sita, right, Rama Sita Kalyanam. Mm. Because we think of it as like our weddings, where it's a festival of gaiety and joy and celebration. But for Swami, it is a event of celebration because it is the Jivatma attaining Brahma Vidya.
Right, it's the moment of enlightenment.
That is possibly the only moment of celebration for Swami. Rest all don't matter. And that's why even when we see Ramkatha Rasa Vahini, almost 40 to 50% of the Ramayana story is only up till the attainment of Brahma Vidya or the wedding of Rama and Sita.
Right.
Like speaking to our Burakatha brothers, three songs that Swami gave, himself composed and gave, out of the two of them were about Rama's wedding. Just imagine, there's a Burakatha on Ramayana and Swami provides two songs, and the distribution is so skewed because both the songs are about the wedding. One is as the people of Ayodhya are moving towards the wedding, the other song is about the people of Mithila celebrating the wedding. So it seemed like heavily skewed, but right now as we were discussing that, suddenly it struck me that this is possibly the reason that Swami gave so much importance to the wedding, Rama Sita Kalyanam, because that is the Kalyanam which is responsible for Loka Kalyanam. Possibly this is the reason why in every Hindu temple, one of the major festivals or ceremonies is the Kalyanam ceremony between the male deity and the female deity, be it at Tirupati, where it is Srinivasa Kalyanam, be it at the Shiva temples, where it is the Parvati, Shiva Parvati Kalyanam, that was also done once at Prashantinilayam,
right.
Or possibly in Rama temples, where we have Sita Rama Kalyanam. So that is the significance of Kalyanam. It is the union that leads to happiness. And Swami says happiness is union with God. So the union of the individual with the Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of God, that leads to Savikalpa Samadhi, as you said.
Right. And now going to that course of Rama's life where these three types of gurus come, of course, in the story, it is like three types of three different individuals come and play the role. But actually in our life, the same guru actually plays these three different roles. The way it happens in the Ramayana is, you know, after they've completed the education, they've learned the art of the arms and all of that, Dasharatha says that you're going to rule the kingdom, so you should see the kingdom before you begin to take upon responsibilities. So he sends them away with the minister, Sumantra, right? Sumantra takes them all across the kingdom, and, you know, Rama is, of course, more interested in the temples. That's what Swami also writes. They go to different temples and kshetras, and Rama sits and has dialogues with many of these enlightened masters. And he gets acquainted with the idea of Advaita, the idea that, you know, there is only God. There is everything else is Maya. And the story goes that when he comes back, he's absolutely confused with this whole thing. Rama, who was supposed to be a very diligent young boy who always respected the elders, who always
did his duties.
Was duties and very, very decorous in that sense, absolutely doing the right thing, precise thing at every point in time in life. Suddenly he finds no meaning in all of this, because he says, if everything is Maya, then what is discipline? Who is elder? Who is younger? Who is worthy of respect? And who is a commoner? And this unsettles him completely. And that's why he doesn't come and offer pranams to his parents every day as it's expected of a prince. He does not come and eat food. He does not go out and play, because he is like lost in this thing that, you know, what is the point of everything? So that is when Dasharatha feels that something is really wrong, and he calls sage Vasishtha, who is the Kula Guru. And Vasishtha, the moment he comes and, you know, sees Rama, he realizes that this is the problem. So the story goes that Vasishtha starts decoding whatever confused state Rama is in for him. He starts explaining him, and that's that body of work is called Yoga Vasishtha. Hmm. And Yoga Vasishtha is filled with stories, different stories and analogies Vasishtha tells to clarify what is Advaita and how do you not get confused, confused between Advaita and what you go through in everyday life. So in that sense, that is the first guru or the first role the guru plays. Because when, the mind is said to be dual in nature. When it is given Advaita, it is actually completely, goes haywire. It does not, what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is morality and what is immorality. So for that, the clarity which the guru gives is what is represented by what Vasishtha explains to Rama in that point.
And we see this happening on a day-to-day basis or at a practical level in the world, when you first get introduced to spirituality, idealism, we possibly read several books, we read so many thoughts, and it leads to a severe indigestion in the head, which leads us to behave in very, very strange ways. In fact, I remember there were at least 2-3 cases when I was a student in the hostel, where 2-3 students would go haywire in the sense, they're not actually mad. It's not that they get deranged or anything, but so much of indigestion. You read about Kundalini, you read Advaita, you read this, you read the works of Ramana Maharshi, you read the works of Ramakrishna, you read Swami's discourses, and finally, you get a kind of state where you feel everything is nothing, and therefore why should you do anything? And there have been cases where I know of a student who went to the exam hall and said, why should I write an exam? What is the use of all this? And just sat, returned an empty paper, came back. So it definitely leads to such kind of indigestion. And that is one very important role the guru plays, because if we could get enlightenment through books, through just interacting with people, talking with all intelligent people around the country, just like how Rama did, then all of us can get enlightened, right? But no, a guru is necessary, because I feel each individual's spiritual journey is a very, very, very personalized one. In fact, reading the autobiography of a yogi, we come across an episode wherein a person comes to seek Paramahamsa Yogananda as his guru, mm-hmm. and the story is revealed how there was an encounter, or they had a chance meeting with Swami Vivekananda in the United States, and at that point in time, Vivekananda is a person who actually saves them from a situation, after which they come and the mother pleads and tells, please accept my child as your disciple, and Vivekananda says, no, the child's guru is coming and he will guide the child. And it turns out that this Paramahamsa Yogananda is the promised guru. So, when you look at this episode, now, does this mean that Paramahamsa Yogananda is greater than Vivekananda, or this guru is greater than that guru? It's not like that. It is the case wherein a disciple or the Shishya is in need of a very personalized path. And for that, therefore, there is a guru who is specialized for that, and that is why it is said that a guru picks out the disciple who is in need of that advice. And that is why we need a guru, and we cannot get our enlightenment through reading of books and reading everything. Even when the Lord came in human form as an avatar in Ramavatar, he needed that kind of counseling and personalized path to be given. And this is one very, very important role that a guru does, because we would have seen this practically. Somebody comes and tells, Swami told this to me. But you think that, this is not what Swami told to me. Swami told this to me. And that is one of the reasons why, while narrating episodes that happened in the interview room, I always make it a point to put this disclaimer that, see, this is personalized wisdom or personalized guidance that Swami gave to that being. Please appreciate the story and get inspired. Don't take that advice as for you, because whatever Swami wanted to dole out for the public at large, he did it so through his discourses. He never held back anything special. But one of the most important roles of the guru, as we discovered in this case, is to give that personalized guidance. And that is one very, very important role that the Sadguru does. And that is what Vasishtha did through the Yoga Vasishtham in the life of Lord Sri Rama.
And we see this many, many times in Swami's life, when he will correct the misunderstanding that we have. It could be a very genuine misunderstanding, right? Genuinely you're trying to understand what Swami is saying, But there could be it. The wisdom is going and settling in the wrong places in your mind. So Swami has to literally say that this is wrong. This is not the way you look at it. Sometimes Swami will make, you know, catch you being a jerk literally in that sense. I recall so many, one of my classmates, you know, in a moment of devotional fervor, he told Swami, "Swami, I don't have any family, I don't have any parents, I just want to serve you, I want to be with you." That moment Swami didn't say anything. Swami was like saying very happy and all that. And a couple of days later or a week later, his parents had come. And Swami had hinted long time ago that when they come, I will give them an interview. Right? And Swami did not give them an interview. And one day in the portico, he got up and he told Swami that, "Swami, my parents are leaving tomorrow." Right? This is like a week after he had that emotional outburst in the interview. And Swami quickly turned back and said, "Just some time back you told me that you don't have parents and you don't have any family, and Swami is my only relative." And this boy was taken aback. Like, you know, Swami was waiting for that moment to tell him that, you know, even that thought came from your mind. Don't get too carried away by it. You have to make it real. You know, Swami did not say what you had was wrong, but that's coming out of your emotion, so that is not the real prayer that you're making. So to point out that, you know, the ability of the guru to say that this is true, this is untrue, this is where you're really doing the right thing, and this is where you think you're doing the right thing, but actually it's wrong. That role the guru plays. Because, see, when the aspirant starts off in this journey to find out the true nature, like the jivatma wants to find out its true nature, it's using the tool of the ego and the mind. So the first mistake the jivatma does is to think the ego is God, right? You think that I am God when you're told that you are God. The ego claims that title of God. And that's where the whole confusion comes in. That's why the guru has to come and say that, no, this is your ego claiming, this is your mind claiming, and this is how you have to deconstruct that whole thing.
You know, when you look at this, there are umpteen instances where, you know, Swami brings in that clarity, the kind of clarity that Vasishtha bought in Lord Sri Rama, and one episode you already narrated. I am reminded of this other episode where Swami asked one of the research scholars, one of our seniors, what is the difference between happiness and bliss? And this brother of ours, he's very well read, well versed in many of these scriptures, and so he started defining what is bliss through all these things. You know, all these scriptural definitions, possibly they are esoteric, they are awesome, they are wonderful to quote, they are good to show how erudite we are, but we know that though I can give definitions of bliss, I just don't understand it at a practical level, nor have I experienced it. And Swami said, Swami just brushed away all the answers and gave possibly the most concise and most beautiful definition of bliss. Swami said, causeless happiness is bliss. Just four words. And if you think of it, it brings so much clarity. Whenever you are feeling happy, think why you are feeling happy. If you are able to find a reason, then know that it's not bliss. As simple as that. I'm feeling happy now. Why am I feeling happy now? Because Swami is talking to me. That's not bliss. Because it has a cause. When you're feeling happy and you ask why you're feeling happy, I don't know, I'm just happy, that is bliss. And even to a person who means I don't think I'm spiritually evolved, but with a little understanding, a little logical brain, this definition makes everything so clear that at least at an intellectual level, I'll be able to separate out, no, this is bliss, this is not bliss. It makes it so easy. I remember a personal experience also. You know, one Swami was speaking about how everyone is divine. He said, everyone is divine, and therefore you have absolute power, you have absolute control. And then he said that you should know what you are, and therefore don't yield to low desires. You know, when the desires come, just shun them away. Just don't yield to them. So I asked Swami, I said, "Swami, it is possible to do this to some desires, but some desires are extremely overpowering. They come and hit with great force and I'm unable to control such desires." And Swami said, "Yes, possibly the desire will hit you with great force. Just hold strong and withstand it once. It'll come and hit you for a second time, withstand it twice. It'll hit you for a third time, withstand it thrice." And then Swami said, and you know, when he's saying it is the divine assurance, Swami said, having done that the fourth time, it won't have any strength to hit. And then Swami said, but the first time it hits itself, you are succumbing and yielding. Therefore, how will you ever be able to hold it, hold against it? Now, I just felt that, Swami, you're putting it off and brushing it off so easily. It's not so easy as that. So I just said, Swami, so basically you're telling me I should suppress my desires. You want suppression. I mean, these were the thoughts that went in my head. What I told Swami was only three words. I said, so Swami, suppression? Instantly, you know, Swami said, suppression kadu, separation. It is not suppression, it is separation. And, you know, again, at least at an intellectual level, it brought so much clarity. It's not about suppressing your desires. It is separating yourself from your desire because you are not your mind. You are not the mind. Till now, it was almost like Swami telling, till now I've been telling that you are God, you are divine. Once you are able to identify with that, ego is nothing but wrong identification. You have wrong identification. Once you identify yourself with the divine, you don't need to suppress the desire because the desire is not yours. You just need to separate yourself from the desires. And even to this day, whenever I find myself battling with desires and problems, I go back to this and derive strength from it. It's not that I don't succumb, I continue to succumb, but at least I have a kind of yardstick or I have a tool which I can hold on to and see. And this is the kind of guidance, divine guidance that a Sadhguru gives, which is magical, which is one very, very important role that he plays in our life.
Right. And that is the clarity which the Sadhguru gives. And invariably, you know, the first role that he plays will result in you knowing what is your role to play. You know, what is your dharma to play. Many times that's what happens. And many times we would see that in Trai Vrindavan or in the portico when Swami asks, some, you know, the wise fellows will come up with the idea of saying, Swami, this body's parents are coming and things like that. Swami will shoot you down literally, you know, if you say something like that because he knows that it's coming from a
intellect,
yeah, it's coming from, you know, intellectually being informed what is the right way of
answering,
putting across the thing. And Swami would say that, no, you are in this body, you're related to some so-and-so in this form, you have a duty to perform to that person. One of the people who were serving Swami physically, you know, every time his mother would come, he would spend a few hours with his mother, he would come out when Swami goes for darshan and come back. So she had come once during a festival and he did not have time to spend. So I think after that, his mother expressed her displeasure that she couldn't spend time this time. And he gave her a full gyan, you know, you're so much attachment you have. And, you know, you're after who's the son, who's the mother and all that. And he felt very happy about, you know, him being able to tell his mother something like that. And when he went back to Swami, he got the, you know, dressing down of his life. Swami was so upset with him. Swami said, see, if you cannot appreciate and acknowledge the love of a mother, being a son, then the higher reaches are not for you. So Swami is telling that it's so important to be perfect within the role that you're playing. That's why the first clarity the Guru gives will lead to you being righteous and being able to do your roles and play your roles and responsibilities exactly. And Swami would say, you know, the first step is karma jignasa. You know what is to be done. That is the first thing that you learn. And going back to the story of Ramayana, you know, first Vasishtha comes and gives this clarity. The story goes that Rama does not get complete clarity. You know, he's a little better off. He's a little more calm, but he's not completely out of it. And immediately the person who comes next into the Ramayana is Vishwamitra. And he's always spoken of as a very, aggressive sage. Because he's a king who has become a sage. He's a kshatriya who has become a sage. So he comes into Dasharatha's court, and we know the story. He first extracts the promise that will you give me what I'm asking for? And Dasharatha says that you have my word. And then he says, you send Rama with me to the forest. And then Dasharatha says that, but he's not well. You know, he's been behaving like this and I'll come with you, I'll do.
He actually wants Rama to the forest to protect a yagna that he's doing from the ogres and rakshasas.
Exactly. And Dasharatha says, I'll come and play that role. He says, nothing doing. You gave me a word that you'll send your son and now you're going back on your word. That's the story part of Ramayana. And finally, Rama does follow, Rama and Lakshmana follow, Vishwamitra through the forest. And this role that Vishwamitra plays is that of the second aspect of a guru, where actually the guru appears a little ruthless. You know, you are confused, you don't know what to do, and you are battling with your own inner pushes and pulls. When the guru steps into your life and says, you know, don't expect compassion from me, you keep quiet and do what I'm asking you to do. He just shuts you off and says that just do what I'm asking you to do. Don't ask me for anything else.
And as we said in the beginning itself, you know, that in the Ramayana, we have got three different people coming and playing these roles. But usually in all our lives, it is the same guru who does all these three and not necessarily one after the other. Sometimes in one act that the guru does, we find two of these roles getting mixed also, you know. He's consoling at the same time directing. You know, he is very clear. I remember, you know, whenever I read all of this, I remember my own life. And I remember on one occasion I had a dream wherein Swami came and told me that, see, your sadhana is just to have my darshan. That was the instruction given at that point in time in my dream. And so I woke up to that. And I remember how that I had just joined Radio Sai a few months before that. And Brother Sai Prakash was there. And he saw that at the least given opportunity, you know, whenever Swami has come for darshan, Swami, you know, those days, Swami would, it was not confirmed that every morning Swami is coming for darshan. But then, it was again not confirmed. Swami would simply go for a drive around Puttaparthi, go near hospital, go that place, go this place, so many places within Puttaparthi. Anytime Swami is out, whatever be the time of the day, on my cycle, I would go behind, you know, behind Swami. And Brother Sai Prakash one day called me and with all brotherly concern, he told me, Arvind, what you're doing is not right. Because Swami has given you a duty, a job at Radio Sai, you better be here and don't go around like that. And what I told him, and then he understood, was he had had an experience wherein after he got his job at Radio Sai, he was found in the darshan hall and Swami told him, I have given you a job there, what are you doing sitting and having darshan here? And he said, that is why I am telling you, you better not get that blasting from Swami. And I told him, the same Swami who told you this, Sai Prakash, told this to me. And his command to me was, your only sadhana you have to do is have my darshan. And that is what I am doing. I am following, you are following Swami's word, I am following Swami's word. I think that's how let it be. And that's how it continued. Sai Prakash would always never, you know, violate in such office timings and studio timings, whereas I would be violating it all the while because I am going for and having darshan. And both of us were fine. And this is what I say, that two roles get combined. It's a very personalized path for each one, and you are told to do some things which may seem not in the flow of things or which is not proper also. But that is what a guru does, because a guru ruthlessly drives each one towards that person's ultimate destiny. And for that, different paths may have to be taken, like there are multiple paths to reach to the top of the mountain. But the top is the same, the ultimate destiny is the same for all, but there may be different paths. And the guru, as Vishwamitra did for Rama, you know, he even gives a mantra to Rama, Bala and Atibala. So the guru ruthlessly drives us towards our destiny, and sometimes that may not be, that is the times when we start feeling the discomfort, because he is ruthless in that, because his sole focus is that we reach our destiny.
I'm reminded of two things. One is, even as we are celebrating the Go Green conference, and you know, one of the greatest miracles in that sense is how Prashanthi Nilayam itself is transformed. And it's not transformed because Swami has said that now let's have greenery all around. You know, it is Swami has labored for that. And some of these old devotees who used to come in the 50s and the early 60s, they used to say that one of the sevas that Swami would make them do is water plants around. And they would spend hours and hours and hours just watering plants. And some of them would come and they would feel that, hey, we've come to the ashram. We've come to lead an ashram life. You know, you should make us sit and do meditation. Give us a discourse. Give us a, you know, a explanation of some Vedanta or something like that. And we are all the time here either sweeping or we are cutting vegetables or washing or we are watering plants. And they would feel very uncomfortable with this idea that you're in the ashram and you're not doing quote unquote spiritual things. And so many times Swami had to literally force them to do that. And sometimes it would be really funny where Swami would come and say, hey, you know, tomorrow early morning, all of you be ready. I'm going to give a discourse. And the moment they hear discourse, they all would be very happy, because all said and done, they're all aspirants who traveled this, you know, they've taken this treacherous journey to come to Puttaparthi and spend a month there. So clearly they were very keen and, you know, absorbing something spiritual. So when Swami would say that I'm going to give a discourse, they all would be very happy. The morning when they assemble, Swami will give them all buckets and say, oh, now go and water the plants. Right? Because Swami was saying that, you know, I don't have to explain something for me to transfer knowledge to you. You do my work, I will ensure that what needs to come to you will come. In fact, when you were saying that it is not like graduating from one section to the one class to the other, where the guru stops playing this role and starts playing another role. Recently, I heard one of the senior most lecturers from the Prashandilim campus. In fact, I think one of the first few principals of the Prashandilim campus, Professor Naidu, who used to be a professor of mathematics, he was saying that at one point he suddenly had a lot of doubts because, you know, he was hearing from the wrong people, he was reading the wrong kind of literature, whatever. He started doubting the simple miracles which Swami would perform, materializations and all that. And his mind was absolutely muddled with all these things going on. It came to a point that he decided that he's going to leave. A lot of other teachers were also leaving with similar confusion, and he thought that, you know, it's time for me to wind up. But probably there was a sincere aspirant within him, and Swami chose to respond to him differently from others. Swami called him for an interview along with his family and few others. And he said, Swami clearly did few miracles just to remove all this confusion from his mind. And when you were saying that, you know, Swami said separation, he was feeling that, you know, Swami was clearly saying that this doubt is not yours. It belongs to the mind and I'm dealing with it this way, right? So he felt that Swami was performing those miracles in a manner he cannot question it reasonably, so that the mind is completely silenced. And he found a certain peace, and that devotion which he had for Swami resume its place because the doubts from the mind were cleared. So that is Swami playing the role of clearing your mind of, you know, the doubt which comes. The next one is, he was saying that in the same interview, Swami had materialized a Rudraksha mala for one of the devotees sitting there. And Swami put it around him very ceremoniously and all that. And he looked at Swami and said, Swami, give me also a talisman. So partially because he was thinking that I should not relapse into this, doubting once more. And he was saying that, Swami, something for me to hold on to, you know, something, an object of faith. And Swami looked at him and said, no talisman for you. Swami pointed to his children who were in the interview. And Swami said, see, these are all your Kama Putras. I mean, children born out of your desire, out of your lust. The students whom you're teaching, my students, they are your Prema Putras. You teach them sincerely, you do that work. Not only this, I'll ensure that you get everything in life. So that many, many times Swami has said this, you do my work, I will ensure what you need to get, you will get at the appropriate time. And that is one aspect of the Guru which probably our mind does not, you know, readily accept, because we want a Guru to give a mantra, we want a Guru to give a discourse, we want a Guru to constantly keep putting us, you know, through spiritual tests, not through these kind of mundane procedures.
We do not realize that there's nothing like a spiritual test or a mundane test. You know, it reminds me of another beautiful episode, but I think I will hold myself because we have one more important segment to complete. But we will go to that segment after taking this little break. Dear listeners, after the break, we have discussed two roles that a guru plays. One is in clearing doubts and assuring, and the other role where he commands us and ruthlessly drives us towards our destiny, tells us what is to be done, even if it means discomfort to us. There's a third role also that he plays, which is again equally and very important, but that we shall discuss after this break. So don't go away anywhere. We'll be back very soon.
Satya Guru Dev, raah dikhaao Prabhu. Satya Guru Dev, raah dikhaao Prabhu. Satya Guru Dev, raah dikhaao Prabhu. राह दिखाओ साई देवा,
राह दिखाओ साई देवा,
राह दिखाओ साई देवा,
राह दिखाओ साई देवा,
सत्य गुरु तुम हो मेरे
Welcome back, dear listeners. Sometime back, one of our brothers who had this great opportunity of staying with Bhagwan at his residence and spending time with him, serving Swami as his personal servitor, he narrated this episode of how he actually possibly got into this position of being Swami's personal servitor. It's a very poignant and very beautiful episode, and it has multiple lessons, and that's why it's relevant here. It so happened that Swami had instructed this brother not to take any money from his parents anymore, because he said that from now on Swami will take care of you, your education, everything, and that is what the brother would be following. And every now and then Swami would himself come and give money to this brother for whatever he needed for his little expenses. Then came a time when Swami, for some reason, he had to go back to his hometown, and Swami also told him, gave him blessings and told him to go. And when he went to his hometown, keeping in mind what Swami had said, he refused to take any kind of money or anything from his parents. But finally, you know, his father, after all, he's a father, he wanted to do something for his son. So his father booked a return ticket for him to come back to Prashantinilam. And his father said, no, shut up, don't pay me back any money. There's nothing, I've just booked your ticket, you're not giving me a chance to do anything at all. And this boy thought also that it's fine. But when he came back to Prashantinilam, Swami was upset with that. You know, Swami was so upset with that he stopped talking to him. He began to avoid this student. And what was the, in quotes, crime that he had committed? He had allowed his father to book a ticket for him to come back, you know. Like, when I look at it, I feel it's no big deal. I mean, what is it? I didn't take money from my father. He just booked a ticket. Come on, what's such a big deal in that? But apparently it was a big deal. And there was a message that Swami wanted to give. And possibly, we will come to that in the end. So Swami completely began to avoid him. And now, this brother was in a kind of a dilemma, you know. Now, because if Swami is not looking at you, Swami is not talking to you, weeks pass, a month has passed, what do you sustain on, you know? You cannot take money from your parents now, because that is the crime for which you are being punished now. In that punishment you can't take. But your only source of sustenance, that is Swami, has stopped giving you anything now, because he's not even talking to you. So slowly what he began to do was, he began to cut down on his meals. He began to eat only in the South Indian canteen, because that is what he could afford. Then after some time, when the amount of money began to dwindle, he began to eat only twice a day. And also, he would, wait eagerly for prasadam to be distributed in mandir, on because on such days he would just possibly try to take an extra prasadam and avoid a meal, skip a meal, save that money. Finally, it shifted to one meal a day. Then it went to a state where he would drink only buttermilk, because if you remember in those days, for 50 paisa is half a rupee, we would get a cup of buttermilk, and he would sustain only on buttermilk. Finally, his whole money got exhausted. He's not telling anybody. He's not asking for money from anyone. He's not yet earning. He can't ask from his own parents. So what? Forget the thought of asking from anybody else. It went to such a situation that this brother would wait, and at the end of a session, when people are throwing food, you know, whatever little remains, your remnants, you put it in a dustbin and then you go and put the plates for wash in the South Indian canteen, he would actually pick food from the dustbin and eat. He went to that state, and there was a senior devotee who saw this and who knew that this boy was, you know, this was a boy with whom Swami used to speak quite a lot and all that. So he went to him and said, "What are you doing? Let me buy you a, you know, what is this?" But this brother just refused to take any food and he walked away. And don't know what happened. It is possible that this senior devotee, when he got the opportunity, he told Swami that Swami, this boy is eating from the dustbin. But when nothing seemed to happen, a week passed. After that, suddenly one day, he was called to the interview room. You know, his stomach was groaning in hunger, but he had that satisfaction that I am following what Swami said. I have violated it once, I will never do it again, and I'm following it. And he was led into the interview room. And you know, like, it almost seemed like adding salt on the wounds, because Swami was seated there with his silver plate, all the choicest of dishes served on it, and Swami was sitting there. And so Swami asked him and said, "What is this that I'm hearing?" You know, Swami began to have a conversation with him, with a feast that had been laid out in front of him. But after a few sentences of conversation, Swami had just eaten one or two morsels. And that is how he would always eat. Though everything is served on his plate, Swami would just eat one or two morsels. After doing that, Swami called this boy and made him sit beside him, offered his own silver plate and told him, "Have this." And that brother was saying, after that day, for years together, that was the practice wherein Swami would, on Swami's silver plate, whatever is served, Swami would partake very little, and the rest, it would be the opportunity, grand, great, divine opportunity for this brother to partake. So, you know, the guru gives a directive, and though it makes us uncomfortable, if we follow that, you know, if we follow that, the reward that comes is unimaginable. This brother, you know, he was in tears. He was saying that, you know what, if I had known, if at all anybody knows that at the end of it, that is what you're going to get as a reward, who will not be ready to do that? But the beauty of that brother's devotion and discipline is that he had the ability to do it without knowing what the reward that is coming. And that is where selflessness comes. And that is what the guru is searching for. So a test will come, and that is the third role that a guru plays. That is rewarding the disciple after testing. And the testing is done only to ensure that we are in a position and capability to utilize the great gift that is being conferred on us. Otherwise, it would be like casting pearls before swine. It will go waste. Therefore, before giving us the greatest reward, the guru tests whether we are having the ability to receive the reward. And then, having tested and found us that, and having found us not wanting, the greatest reward is conferred. That is the third role the guru plays that we see even in the Ramayana. The role of testing the disciple and then conferring the ultimate.
Exactly. And that's precisely what happens in the Ramayana, because, you know, Vishwamitra, as we said, he plays that role of a ruthless guru who says, "I don't care about your confusion. I don't care about your needs." I mean, literally in that sense. And he says that you do what I want you to do. It appears like a selfish thing. He says, "I am doing a yajna, I want you to come and protect it." And like many people say that, you know, Swami wants to run an organization, he's using us for that. Somebody can be as silly as that. But it appears like that sometimes. But at the end of it, what does Vishwamitra do? He takes Rama to the place where Sita is. He takes Rama to the, you know, footstep of the point where he is going to attain that Brahma Vidya. And after that comes this third role where Janaka says that, you know, I will test. I will not take you for, I will not give it to you without testing you. And
Janaka is the father of
you know, Mother Sita. And he says, and Swami would say, you know, what is the test Rama has given? He has given the, you know, the stringing of the bow, that is the Shivadhanush. And Swami would say that that bow represents ego. And stringing the bow actually means the ability to bend the ego in such a manner that you can use the ego. You know, it's not about transcending the ego at this stage, just the ability to use your ego, to bend it and to make it an instrument. And probably that's where Rama gives a hint that he is not human. He is actually an avatar. He's a descent of divinity because he breaks the bow. Mm-hmm. You know, he says that, forget about bowing it, stringing it and using it. I'm actually beyond even that. He breaks it and probably establishes divinity. But that is the test which the guru gives. Are you able to string this bow and utilize it? And if you are able to conquer your ego, then you deserve to receive Brahma Vidya. That's why Janaka does Kanya Dhan. He is the third aspect of the guru, where the guru can bestow that knowledge on the disciple once he finds that he is suitable to receive it, he or she is suitable to receive it.
You know, this third role where the guru tests to see that, are we truly identifying, you know, what is it that we are identifying ourselves with? Because the ultimate, the Brahma Vidya or Brahma Gyan is nothing but realization of one's true identity. And to realize one's true identity, one has to demolish and break through all the false identities that we identify ourselves with, be it with our profession, be it with our roles as a parent or as children or as brother or sister, all those identification, body identification, mind identification, we have to give up. And that, whether we have given it up or not, gets tested in multiple ways, you know, because it can get tested by us losing our wealth. It can get tested by us losing our health. Because when any of this, we lose any of these, health, wealth, relationships, friendships, any of this, if we feel that we are suffering, we have lost, then we are still wrongly identifying. You know, it has to be broken. And that is why we see the greatest devotees, be it Tyagaraja or Mirabai, they seem to be suffering all their life. But the reality is, since their identification is right, they've identified themselves with the ultimate, in their own opinion, they're not suffering. Tyagaraja never said that I am suffering penury or I am suffering poverty. Mirabai never said that I am suffering pain and torture. But we look at their lives and say, Lord, they were your greatest devotees and yet they suffered so much. That's because our identification is wrong and that has to be broken, that has to be changed, that has to be strung, as you put it. That is the third role the guru does. And if we say that, yes, oh guru, I am ready, I've got my identification right. It's like in an airport when you go and say, yes, I am this, they say, can I have some identity? Can I have some proof of that? In the same way, as proof of it, a test is put. And if we pass the test, we get Brahma Gyan. If we fail the test, again, the other roles continue, where the guru counsels, he comforts, he directs. It continues like that. I'm reminded of one little episode. I think Mrs. Bhatnagar, she has recorded this, wherein in the interview room, she asked, Swami asked her what she wants. She said, Swami, I want nothing but Sai Krupa. Swami said, do you know what comes along with the Sai Krupa, along with Sai Krupa? She said, what is it, Swami? Swami said, with Sai Krupa comes the three zeros. What is that? The zero of wealth, the zero of health, the zero of friendships and relationships. Everything is taken away. That is how Sai Krupa comes. And she writes that at that point she said, Swami, maybe then I don't want Sai Krupa. You know, so we come seeking the ultimate, but we are so fixed in our own little things that we actually don't want the ultimate. Only theoretically we keep stating that we want the ultimate. And that is why, you know, the guru holds forth a mirror in front of us to show what reality is, so that we wake up from that slumber and truly seek the ultimate. And then when we pass the test, gives us the ultimate. That is what, as you said, Janaka Maharshi, he's actually a king, but he's a sage too. He does this third test for Lord Sri Rama before granting him Mother Sita, who is representative of Brahma Vidya.
And Swami would say this, you know, guru is one who is who has the ability, and I think in one of Swami's Guru Purnima discourses, Swami had said, you know, I think he mentioned 8 or 15, I don't know, types of gurus, where Swami would say Bodha Guru, Bada Guru, Mantra Guru, and you know, these are different kinds of gurus that are in the world. Some gurus you go to only when you are in trouble. Some gurus you go to when you want a mantra. Some gurus you want to, you just go and listen to their discourse. And Swami would say that these are all different types of gurus in the market. You can go and pick. Not that everybody is bad or everybody is having some malified intent. It's not in that sense. But Swami would say that different people play different roles. But the Sadguru is not like that. The Sadguru is one who will be able to take you from being, you know, playing the role of an acharya, as we said. You can see him and you can learn. You can take his words and you can learn. From that point, Swami says, to the point of the Guru saying that I will give you. And Swami has said this, and you know, on many occasions, Swami would say, you do this, I will give you Sakshatkar. Swami would say, I will give you the realization. Only a Sadguru has the, you know, has the authority to say that. I can grant you that ultimate. And Swami says, for that what? I think the most important part is that huge section in between where Swami says, you do what I'm asking you to do. And I will ensure that from time to time you will get, you know, the promotion in the spiritual path that you need. And this testing will be happening intermittently. And many times if you see, you know, what we all go through in the Sai organization, in our samitis, in our corporate life, is that, is this ability to string your ego? Are you able to control your ego and do something for the higher good? Are you able to control your ego and do what you're supposed to do? That's probably the greatest challenge that we have. And that is where I think most of us falter, because, you know, we say that I'm an achiever, I don't need to do this. Or if you're not able to fit into any situation, you walk out of that situation. And Swami would say that, again, to many, many teachers, when Swami would speak, Swami would say, no, you don't have to run away from here. You will find it in this path itself. And like we've mentioned many times, Bhagya Sir's incident, where Swami told him, and Swami said, you do my work, I will give you the ultimate which you're seeking. That's my responsibility.
On that note, dear listeners, it should be a strong prayer in our hearts that having found the Sadguru, or rather, having been blessed that the Sadguru has found us, we hold on to him, never let go of him. Let us realize that everything that Swami is doing is out of immense compassion and love for us. Even things that seem painful appear, not seem, they are painful, they are troublesome, but they are also for our good. Because the Guru always does this. When we are most in need of help, he helps us, but he never compromises on the ultimate goal. His love is of the highest type, and therefore he cannot allow us to stray. He will keep prodding us and guiding us towards, goading us towards that ultimate goal. He'll never stop at that. So we should actually be grateful for that. And with these thoughts, let us offer our utmost gratitude and love to Bhagwan tomorrow. I mean, we can do it now anytime, but tomorrow is a special day reserved for the reverence and worship of the Guru. May we utilize this Guru Purnima to grow stronger in our love for our Guru, to grow deeper in our conviction towards our Guru, and to always follow him, for nothing else is worth following in this universe. We will end with a song, on the other side of which, as always, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
हाँ।